Let's see, Representative Cox, have you had a chance to take a look at the minutes?
I have, and they look fine, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Cox moves the minutes from, what's the date on here? Wednesday, March 10th. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails, minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Cox. Okay, members, we've got a lot of bills to get through and a number of people that want to testify today. We're going to get rolling, and hopefully we can keep on a good pace. The chair will move House File 2242. Representative Sikora,
thank you.
Present your bill.
2242 is really a resolution to Congress, and what it attempts to do is begin to solve the issue that we've had for a long time in Minnesota, that there were many acres of permanent trust lands, permanent school trust lands, that went into the Boundary Waters Canoe area. And we have never in any way been compensated for any of that land. So what we're looking for here is a start. We want to begin to address this issue. We want to do it in a way that indicates that we as Minnesotans are unified on getting this done. We're trying to work with the people who are in the environmentalist area as well as the people who are concerned about finances for schools for which the permanent school trust lands were dedicated and get at least a start on something happening here. This bill does a couple of things. It's pretty simple. It's what it does is it asks Congress to enact an increase of $3 in the existing Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Reservation Fee to be allocated to Minnesota's Permanent School Trust Fund. And just before we started this meeting, Deputy Commissioner Holston mentioned that it probably should say each person that enters the area instead of just reservation fee, because it might make quite a difference. One person might be reserving for 5 or 10 people. That's the first time I've heard that. We're going to check on that and possibly try to just change that little section when we go to the floor, if that is the case, to try and maximize. Right now, the possibility is maybe $60,000 to $90,000 more coming into the permanent school trust land per year with this change. So we're going to check that out, Mr. Chairman, before we get to the floor, but it was too late this morning to find out. And then in addition, we want to get our congressional delegation, et cetera, our departments working toward a final solution, whether it be they pay us for the land, whether it be they trade some of the federal forest lands, whatever, for the boundary water lands, whether it's a combination of those things. But I think it's time. It's been a lot of years. It's time. And just to indicate that there is support within other communities, I have Kevin Kreshold here who will, from the Isaac Walton League, who will briefly comment to the committee. I know you're in a hurry, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Kreshold, and I'm the Wilderness and Public Lands Director for the Isaac Walton League of America. I'm pleased to be here to add our organization's support to Representative Sikora's bill and a chance to start the process of getting some money to the Permanent School Fund for these school trust lands within the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. The state has had a long involvement with the Boundary Waters over the years and has passed laws in the past, implemented rules, but we've never adequately addressed this issue of the fiduciary responsibility to the Permanent School Fund. And we believe this is a great start, and we're pleased to support Representative Sikora. Thank you very much.
Very good. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chairman Hagbard. As you can see, I co-authored this bill with Representative Sikora, and I'd like to thank her for her work on this and also thank the other organizations who have been in the loop on this. I did, when I signed on to this, I did, Representative Sikora, believe that we were talking about $3 per person, not a reservation.
I assumed that's what it was, too.
Yeah, and so I think that is something we need to look at. However, I know we're in a hurry. I want to just bring this up very quickly. Even though I think that the evaluation done by UMD on our lands that are in the Boundary Waters is too low, and we talked about that last session, at $91 million, we are leasing school trust lands now in Minnesota, like lakeshore lease lots, the three that are left on Horseshoe Bay at 2%. Well, if you do the math on that, 91 million, 2%, this is a drop in the bucket. I just want to be on the record that this is a beginning. I'm supporting it. It's an interim solution, and that as the representative for that area, all of the Boundary Waters lies within my district, I want a resolution, a final resolution that's within the confines of the provision of the Constitution of the State of Minnesota that I said that I swore to withhold, to uphold. With that being said, I'm ready to move forward.
Thank you, Representative Bill. Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sikora, Mr. Peschel, do you know what the current fee is for entering the reservation?
Representative Sikora.
You know, I've heard a couple of conflicting things, but what I had heard was $12, and this would up it to
$15.
Copy. Yes. Representative Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My quick question for you, Representative Sikora. Where do these fees currently go, just out of curiosity? How are they being utilized?
This is essentially a federal park, and this is a federal fee. That's why we have to go to Congress for this. But this $3 would be coming to Minnesota.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's right. The money, the present fee that's charged, goes to the federal government and is allocated through a couple of different formulas. Small amounts going to the counties. It's a convoluted thing. What I see is Congress is going to have to memorialize this fee specifically to our school trust fund. So they're going to collect, as I see it, and I stand corrected, Kevin knows a lot about this, Mr. Preschel knows a lot about this, they'll have to have some type of legislation that says that the $3 above the normal Boundary Waters fee is dedicated to the Minnesota School Trust Fund.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions?
Is that right?
Anyone that would like to speak for or against the bill? With that, the chair will renew his motion that House File 2242 be recommended to pass and be referred to General Register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. Bill is adopted and sent to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Sikora. Thank you. Next on the agenda, Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Seifert, the chair will move House File 2424 to bring the bill before us. Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, House File 2424 lays out some procedures for development and what I would say some fairness in the development of TMDL reports. It has been brought forward by Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I'm carrying it on their behalf. Section 1 will give some definitions, purposes of the bill, including what a TMDL is, total maximum daily load. I'm sure members of this committee are somewhat familiar with that. Next, subdivision in 3 requires the PCA to give notice to anyone requesting in the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the State Register that it plans to submit a TMDL report on a body of water as required by federal law. Follows similar to what we would do in administrative procedures under government operations, if any of you are on that committee, allows 25 or more people that are affected by the proposed report requests for a contested case hearing for possible report changes. The next section requires a statement of need and reasonableness, which the acronym that most of us use in GovOps is a SONAR. It requires the PCA to file a statement of their SONAR of a TMDL report, including compliance costs, alternative methods and costs, assessment of differences between the report and federal regulations, and then finally in Subdivision 5, request for contested case proceeding. Procedures are laid out there. And in detail, I'll turn it over to Mr. Steve Nias, who's with the Coalition, and Mr. Keith Nelson, who's the Public Works Director for the City of Winona, to give some brief testimony, and then I'll stand for questions.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Nias. I'm with Flaherty and Hood.
representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I also served on the G16 Group of 16 policy work group that put together a legislative proposal and policy framework for the implementation of the Impaired Waters Program, which I believe this committee may have been briefed on a time or two already. This legislation was developed sort of to fit hand in glove into the G16 proposal, and even if the G16 proposal didn't move forward, this provides some very good basic notice requirements, some basic elements to help keep the affected public informed when these TMDL reports are being put together. Representative Seifert, I think, did a very good job of covering the basics of the bill here. I just wanted to call attention to a couple of items. In subdivision 4C, which I believe will be on page 4 of your bill, there's an item identified in there, item C, nothing in this section shall be interpreted as requiring the agency to adopt rules for TMDL plans. This was done in response to some concerns that were brought to us by the Pollution Control Agency about, along the lines of, wait a second, you're expecting us to do a TMDL report and then a whole big sonar along with it. That was certainly not the intent of the legislation. The TMDL report is designed to be a comprehensive identification of the problem that's causing the impairment, the setting of a waste load allocation, the scientific data backing it up, and then an allocation of that load among point and non-point sources. A lot of those elements are already in some of the TMDL reports that are being put together now, for example, in the Lower Minnesota River, the Long Prairie River, the Lower Mississippi River. And so this just adds some clarification to that that can be built right into the TMDL reports that are being put together now. Item B under subdivision 5, we make a reference there to a scientific review panel. This again was an issue that cities were very concerned about, making sure that the scientific data that goes into a TMDL report is sound. Actually, the G16 proposal contains a small allowance for this as well. This just formalizes it a little bit more to, if we get to a situation where there's a dispute, a contested case hearing has been requested, that scientific review panel provision then kicks in to make sure that the scientific basis is sound. And finally, the last portion of the bill, subdivision 5E, making clear here that nothing would limit a person from requesting a contested case proceeding after the adoption of the TMDL plan. What we want to do here is kind of along the lines of, I know construction folks say frequently doing it right the first time is a lot cheaper than doing it over, and that's exactly where this is headed. We want to provide a process where if there are serious, legitimate problems with a TMDL report, those can get resolved before it gets sent to the EPA for approval, and those things can get worked out. But at the same time, sometimes we're not going to catch everything. And so we do want to allow the regular public notice and contested case allowances that currently exist under existing law. So I will just leave it at that and turn the floor over to Mr. Nelson.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Keith Nelson. I'm Director of Public Works for the City of Winona. The implementation of TMDL allocations will likely be controversial. It certainly will have significant impact throughout Minnesota. The TMDL procedure bill before you requires public publication and notice for 30 days prior to being sent to the EPA. Allowing stakeholders an opportunity to comment prior to submission to the EPA will allow any resulting changes to be made before implementation. That's like setting a good foundation before building the house. HF 2424 will also require the preparation of a statement of need and reasonableness. Good engineering analysis compares the cost to benefits on the affected persons. It also looks at what the other options would be that should be considered, and what is the estimated cost of compliance. That information should be available to the public before submission to the EPA. Additionally, TMDL procedure bill allows a contested case hearing if a minimum of 25 people formally request such a hearing. The crucial part of such a hearing would be peer review. Submission to a scientific review panel would be required for the hearing. The panel would be created by the MPCA and composed of disinterested individuals from education, research, and technical organizations who have expertise in the methods used to determine the TMDL allocations. The panel would present their findings as part of the hearing process. The requirements of this TMDL process bill are reasonable, fair, and consistent with good scientific practice. It is my request that you give thoughtful consideration to this bill as it is before you. Thank you, Mr. Chair of the Committee.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to clarify, Representative Seifert, if we can here. On the first page, you are asking for a TMDL report for a pollutant for any impaired waters. I'm reading lines 23 and 24 on page 1. So the way I read this, it is for any segment, for each individual segment of impaired water, like on a river or a lake. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, I yield to Mr. Nias on that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius. Under the Federal Clean Water Act, the requirement is that a TMDL has to be done for each pollutant. But what the BCA has been doing so far, and I believe all of the G16 members were generally in support of this, is to, for purposes of economies of scale, to bundle things together. So, for instance, I believe the TMDL that was put together for the Lower Mississippi River on fecal coliform, I believe that particular TMDL report addressed 20 to 25 impairments. I'm not positive about the number, but there's certainly economies of scale that have to be done, but at the same time, the agency still has to work within the requirements of the federal law that there has to be a TMDL for each pollutant.
Representative Wiggins.
I appreciate that, because I've been sitting here trying to do the math of this proposed way of doing TMDLs. And we, the PCA has testified before us that we will have 10,000 TMDLs by 2014. And I am imagining that we have 2 to 6 pollutants in each segment. Maybe it's 1 to 6. Let's say 1 to 6 pollutants in each segment. Am I being fair about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I think that's fair. Yeah.
So, if I do the math on this, that you have 10,000 times possibly 60, that's 60,000 contested case hearings. Even, and of course lakes will all have to be individual, but even if you were to take some of the streams out or the rivers out and bundle them, you could maybe divide half of that by 25, so we have 30,000, and then divide half of it by 25. I don't do the math, but this seems to be like bureaucracy gone amok. I mean, I'm just startled that we are proposing so many contested case hearings. And I would ask the chair if this is going to finance, please.
If this bill moves on, there's a number of places that has to go, Representative Wagner.
Well, the only
finance included.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Wassler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, too, is related, I think, to the bureaucracy. As Representative Wagenius mentioned, you create a scientific review board, yet I assume you've got standard tests that are done, VODs, CODs, you're checking for coliform. What's the purpose? Can't PCA oversee this?
Nice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wasiluk, the G16 actually talked about that issue quite a bit, and we've talked about the possibility of a standing scientific review panel. The G16 left it fairly open, and I think the intent of our legislation is to leave it fairly open as well, because as sort of the problem for Minnesota is that although the TMDL requirements have been around for decades, we're just now getting really up to speed to developing and implementing TMDLs. What the folks on our group seem to sort of agree on is that over time there's going to be a certain number of models that will sort of become the generally agreed upon, accepted methods. Now, that deals with the specific models. Other issues, however, that come into play that sometimes will lead to contested cases are the age of the data, the sufficiency of the data, which doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the model itself, but rather with the data on which the model is based. I know in the Minnesota River Basin, we've got a model that's been put together. That TMDL is currently out on public notice now, but it's also based on some data that was pulled together in 1985, and one of the questions kind of came up as far as, you know, how does, should we base the 2003 model on the 1985 data? So those are the kinds of issues that that could be vetted out during that scientific review process.
Mr.
Chair, so the scientific review board, would they oversee the modeling? And I'd be concerned. You've got some simple testing that can be done to examine water quality and what's happening. And if you're modeling, I'd be concerned that some of these simple tests would be left out perhaps as a cost containment measure. E. coli testing is very simple. And other tests that could be done. But I want to get to the crux of what the scientific review panel will do. Will they oversee the actual modeling, or is that would be more of a technical PCA piece?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wasiluk, under the federal law, before any TMDL can go to the EPA for approval, it has to be signed off on by the PCA, and that's an extremely important gatekeeper. Another issue that we discussed was whether third parties could do their own modeling studies and then submit those as TMDLs. And the thought was the PCA has the expertise, has the scientific knowledge to oversee that process. What we've seen in TMDLs that are being put together right now is that the agency will tend to farm those out to private engineering firms to do the modeling analysis. And that works out fine so long as the PCA has the final say in making sure that, yes, the science is sound, yes, the allocations are fair, and yes, it can go on to the EPA.
Okay, members, I'm going to try to cut things a little bit short here. If MPCA would like to come up and give their opinion on this issue, Ms. Thorvig?
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I do have some of the same concerns that were brought up about the potential number of contested case hearings and what PCA may have to deal with administratively. And if there is a motion and the committee is favorable on at least moving on, even if it's without recommendation to Representative Osmond's committee, I think that's there's some pretty serious concerns about that are very legitimate. And I don't know, I hope you'd like to see the bill, but if Representative Osmond's committee would be the next stop, that would be my preference, because I think there are some real legitimate concerns that could be addressed.
Representative Seifert, I've got some real concerns with other parts of the bill, too. I'd like to hear what MPCA has to say.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Thorvig, Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I actually have 4 points that I want to cover during my presentation. The first one is that this bill is not a recommendation of the Impaired Water Stakeholders Group. It did not come out of the group known as the G16. In fact, the stakeholders group actually addressed how we would like the TMDL process to proceed, and it was as a cooperative process up front so that we wouldn't have disagreements at the end. And the proposed legislation that the G16 came up with put in place a science review panel, and the idea was for people to come to agreement on the science and the models up front before we even started a TMDL. So this bill pushes everything into a confrontational mode at the back end instead of the cooperative process that the G16 was trying to put in place in the front end. So that's my first point. The second point is that the Clean Water Act actually includes a prohibition for new or expanded discharges to an impaired water until a TMDL has been completed and approved by EPA. So this bill would slow down the ability to get TMDLs completed. And what that would mean is that new projects or expansions couldn't happen in an area until the TMDL was approved. So a new ethanol plant in the southeast could not move forward without the approved TMDL. An animal feedlot could not move forward. In the metro area, development that needed a stormwater permit could not move forward if it was going to be discharges to an impaired water that needed a TMDL. So this actually works very much against economic development and community development. So that's my second concern. Third, this bill puts in place an issue that I think the legislature has viewed negatively, and that's the idea of allowing an open-door petitioning process that any 25 people can ask for a contested case hearing and it must be held. In some cases, those petitions are valid, but we do have in law a way to get to contested case hearings for valid requests. This would allow frivolous requests from people who are interested in delaying an ethanol plant or a feedlot or a new development from asking for a contested case hearing, and then we must go to contested case hearing. So I think that's poor public policy, and it's actually something that people have been concerned about with regard to the environmental review process and trying to get away from that kind of open-ended process that allows frivolous requests. And finally, this would have significant financial impact on our agency to produce sonars, which are currently required for rulemaking. We only do a few rulemakings a year, and those are thousands of dollars, plus holding all these contested case hearings. So it's a significant financial impact that we would need funding in order to move in this direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Commissioner Thorvick? Thank you, Ms. Thorvick. Well, members and Representative Seifert, we've got a huge agenda to get through today. I think I'm hearing some real concerns from our members. I'd rather not take a vote on the bill and take a chance of it going down. I think at this time I'll lay over House File 2424.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hoppe, House File 2706. Representative Hoppe moves House File 2706 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register?
I believe so. I can't think of anywhere else it would go, Mr. Chairman.
Hold it. Government operations.
I think unless government operations wants to see it, that would be a wise thing.
That's where she's going.
Mr. Chair and members, I hesitate to use the words a simple bill, but all we're looking to do is extend the life of some advisory councils, and with that I will turn it over to the expert, Mr. Benke from OEA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Dave Benke. I'm with the Office of Environmental Assistance, where I'm the Strategic Directions Manager there. I think a simple bill probably never is simple, but we'll just explain what we're trying to do here. And what we propose is to get extensions to three select advisory councils for the Office of Environmental Assistance. As you're aware, the office utilizes partnership to a great deal to implement and utilize their programs. One of those cornerstones is an understanding from our stakeholders' perspectives on the programs and the delivery of our services. Three select advisory committees that we're working on include our Pollution Reduction and Recycling Advisory Council, our Solid Waste Management Advisory Council, and our Environmental Education Advisory Board. The Pollution Reduction and Recycling Advisory Council is dedicated to increasing the level of pollution prevention, reduction, reuse, and recycling throughout Minnesota, including the reduction of toxicity in products. The Solid Waste Management Advisory Council is dedicated to increasing the effectiveness of our program delivery in the area of solid waste, and an analysis in conjunction with the progress that we're making, as well as our ability to implement an integrated waste management system throughout the state. Both advisory committees, the Solid Waste and the Pollution Prevention, provide us with an independent outside information to ensure that our program delivery is done in a kind of a real-world check situation. We've included industry representatives, local government representatives, as well as citizens on both of those advisory councils. The Environmental Education Advisory Board is a little bit different. It serves a wide range of needs in the environmental education community. It offers direction to all various agencies, to the environmental education organizations, and to policymakers working on environmental education issues. Its makeup is a little bit different. It includes representation from state agencies, including the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Education, the Department of Agriculture, Department of Health, DNR, Bowser, and EQB, as well as citizen representation from all the congressional districts, and including licensed teachers. So this is a way that we garner the input and the information in terms of environmental education issues. We do have a main request, and that is an extension through June 30th, 2007. There's one minor modification we would need to make to the language on the second page on lines 15, where we would insert notwithstanding section 15.059 subdivision 5. That makes it consistent with the other advisory councils, and what that does is it looks at the date that's set in 15.059 and allows this date of June 30th, 2007 to take precedence. So,
Representative Hoppe, you'd like to move that amendment?
I would, and Mr. Chair, and that would go after subdivision 6, after the period, towards the end of line 15. And Mr. Helen's got it.
Okay. Everybody understand? All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails, amendment's adopted. Any further testimony, Representative Hoppe?
Not that I'm aware of, unless there's anybody in opposition, and I'm not aware of any.
Any questions from the members? Seeing none, anyone in the audience speak for or against the bill? Okay, Representative Hoppe moves that House File 2706 be recommended to pass and be as amended, and be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations, Veterans Affairs. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ben Keem and Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Let's see. Representative Simpson. Okay, the chair will move House File 2500. Be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I have a voice amendment I'd like to add on to this, if I could, please.
Okay, Representative Simpson.
And that would be under subsection 2B, label it D.
What page are you on?
It'd be on page 2. If you just label it D, and it would be just the voice would read, this act is effective the day following final enactment. And I have checked, and all parties are in agreement with doing this.
Mr. Hill?
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Simpson just wants a new section 2 effective date section that would be the day following final enactment.
Yes, yes.
Very good.
Okay.
Chair will move that amendment. All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails, amendment adopted. Okay, Representative Simpson, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2500, which will simplify the law surrounding polychlorinated biphenyl, better known as PCB, while retaining environmental protection. This bill amends existing law. You won't be surprised to know that part of the reason for the need for this bill is Minnesota's history of being a strong leader in environmental protection and consumer protection. Back in the 70s, Minnesota was ahead of the federal government in regulating PCBs. Now the federal government has caught up. Reflecting this, this bill will eliminate duplicative state requirements concerning labeling, emergency planning, and training. A major obstacle in the eventual elimination of PCB contaminating equipment is the cost of complying to current regulation and paying the fees. There is a disincentive to phase this more hazardous equipment out. This bill, by waiving fees and simplifying federal and state requirements, provide an incentive for the removal of PCB equipment. This bill would maintain reasonable oversight because under this legislation, utilities could present a plan to MPCA to remove equipment. If approved, the utilities could carry out their plan without extra fees and paperwork. This, members, is a very reasonable bill. I urge you to support this bill. I think it's excellent for business, excellent for the environment, and excellent for our state. And I have Representative Mark Gerlach with Excel here. If anybody has any questions, I'm sure he can help us out.
Okay. Questions from the committee. Representative Osman.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that I have checked with the department. This is revenue neutral, so there's no fiscal impact.
Correct. Okay. Any other questions? Representative Wagenius.
Okay. I just need some clarification on understanding here. Mm-hmm. From what I see so far, that you're saying that you believe that people would take out the electric equipment and treat it as the hazardous waste that it is, as long as they didn't have to pay the hazardous waste fees. Is that all your bill is accomplishing, yeah, or am I misreading or not reading it correctly?
Representative Simpson?
I'll refer that to Mark. Maybe you can answer that a little bit.
Please identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Okay. I'm Mark Gerlach, a senior environmental analyst with Xcel Energy. Some clarification on how this works. PCBs being regulated as a state hazardous waste, when we generate those, we have to pay a fee on that each year as part of licensing as a hazardous waste generator, just like we do for all our other hazardous waste that we generate. And I guess the thing to clarify here is this isn't waiving all fees on PCBs. It's not going to waive the equipment that we take out of service because it's being retired from its end of service life, essentially, and found to contain PCBs. This is more of a proactive type of a removal of PCBs. We have the option, and we've been encouraged by EPA as well as the MPCA to voluntarily go out and identify equipment that has more than 50 parts per million PCBs in it, and to remove that. And so what we're looking for here is a waiver on those fees associated with the equipment that we voluntarily take out of service. And it's equipment that we essentially would be taking out of service before it's actually reached its end of life, end of service life.
Representative Wagenius.
I understand where you're going, I think, but I'm troubled with whether your language is saying what you're telling us. And that's, you're eligible for waiver from your annual hazardous waste fees, yet we're hearing that that's revenue neutral, so you're not paying any fees?
This would be for, I guess the way to look at it, this would be future fees. We've got equipment that has over 50 parts per million PCBs, and we would choose, even though the regulations do not require us to do anything with that until it becomes a waste, we would be choosing to go out and remove those PCBs from service ahead of time. And so basically what you're looking at is it may be something that it may be a piece of equipment that lasts another 10, 20, 30 years before it would come out of service, and then we would pay the fees and dispose of it at that point. What we're saying is, we're looking for some to remove that disincentive that have come out today and began to remove some of that equipment.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerlach, I think I'm understanding it. Essentially, what the bill is doing is, I assume Xcel and other energy producers have inventories of, and they know which transformers and products contain PCBs. What this bill would do is, if you voluntarily decide to survey your equipment and remove, let's say you're going to remove 10% of the transformers that have PCBs voluntarily, you won't pay fees for the removal and disposal of that. You will still do all the paperwork, all the proper handling of the materials, but you just simply won't pay it on that. But you would pay fees on anything that came up, for example, an emergency situation where you had to remove it because it was leaking or something. You would continue to pay all those fees. So when Representative Osmond said it would it would be a fee neutral, it's just that you're really waiving advance fees, because that equipment ultimately would fail sometime between now and the next 50 years, and you would be paying fees at that time when it failed. But by taking it out of service early, you're not paying those fees.
Correct. Right. Okay. So the benefit is, you know, the hazard is the presence and the potential for a release, and by removing that piece of equipment early ahead of its end of service life, you know, reduces that risk.
All right. I've got it. Thank you.
Any other questions? Anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Okay, with that, the chair will renew his motion that House File 2500 be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the general register. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is adopted and moved to the general register. Thank you,
Chairman.
Representative
Committee.
Simpson. Representative Gunther. Representative Gunther. Just in time. Welcome to the committee, Representative Gunther. Representative Cornish will move House File 2633. Be recommended to pass. And where are we sending that one? General Register.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is a proposal that came from a company in South Dakota that wants to build an ethanol plant of 100 million gallons in Martin County, the county that I reside in. Welcome, Minnesota, to be specific. And they are looking at two sites. One's in Fort Dodge, Iowa. The other one's in Martin County. They are wanting to figure out the differences, and it would help solidify our chances, in fact, more than that, with the rail line we already have there. It's almost a foregone conclusion that the plant will be located in Minnesota with its up to 80 jobs. And in greater Minnesota, that's very important. That's probably like industry with 500 jobs up here in the metro area or more. So what we've done is we have said that basically that we want to eliminate the automatic EIS for a plant of 50 million gallons or more that is in rule, and insert in the amendment that we have, A1 amendment, 125 million gallons, which is recommended by the commissioner of the PCA, to go at a higher level. And I would like to move that amendment now, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Cornish will move the A1 amendment. Everybody understand the amendment? Representative Cornish moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. And then amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then we have two oral amendments, one on page 1, on line 24, after the word no, put mandatory environmental impact. And then on another error was on, where is that?
Line 1, page 2.
After of, strike water and put ethanol.
Okay, those two word changes, I think everybody understands that. That's pretty simple. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, the other statement I'd like to make is the reason that we're trying to change rule here and not let them go through their normal process, because I think they're going through the process of looking at their rules today. I think the reason is the timeliness of this. If it wasn't for the fact that this company is going to make up its mind sometime in late spring where this plant's going to go, and this will make the difference, I would not be doing this. But basically what we're asking you to do is say, then the EAW is going to be taken here. Then if that precipitates an EIS, we would be very happy to allow that to happen then. But automatically we thought that that expense would make the difference between this plant being built in Minnesota or Iowa.
Very good. Questions from the committee members? Representative Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gunther, I think economic development is really important. Jobs are really important right now because there aren't many of them. There's a lot of folks without jobs. And I have no problem with incenting businesses, trying to attract businesses to our state. That's a good idea. It's just a matter of what the incentives are. What I don't want to lose sight of, which I've seen too much of since I've been in this job, is erosion of property rights. People want to have the ability to, number one, have an environmental review. All it does is it helps the people within the community to understand if there will be an impact, so that we, kind of measure twice and cut once. And so, yes, indeed, it's very important, and maybe an environmental review after it's done, they'll say it'll be a good report, and they can move forward, but I'd rather avoid problems to begin with if we can. We need to find that happy balance between the people who currently live there and the business that wants to come in, and I hope that we don't lose that as a tradition as a state.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Otto, I totally agree with you. We don't want to force things down people's throats. This plant is a replication of plants that exist today. They were visited by the Commissioner of PCA and the Commissioner of Deed. At 20 below zero, they stood outside and looked at them, by the way. And there was nothing wrong with the environment that the surrounding area has with the existing plant. There are many other plants in Minnesota that are 45 million gallons or less. The impact on the neighbors and the impact on the environment would be basically the same with this plant as it is at any other plant. The only difference is it will make more ethanol. And the mandates as far as odor and other things will be adhered to in this plant just like they are the other ones. In fact, I give you a good example where that mandate helped a plant that is in my district in Corn Plus in Winnebago. They are now converting, taking the things that cause the odor in an ethanol plant, the corn syrups, and they're putting it in a tray situation. They're burning those, eliminating the odor as well as eliminating the necessity for natural gas. So that mandate, farmers have a way of turning negatives into positives, so I think we will address that. We certainly are going to adhere to the EAW process. We think that's very important. We are just eliminating the expensive EIS mandatorily out of this process.
Representative Virginia.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gunther, I know we eliminated the water and put ethanol in instead, but water is a huge issue here. And it seems to me that we know that these ethanol plants take a lot of water. And over our state, it is not intuitive, but there are areas in this state that have very little groundwater. If you go to the northeast, there's practically none. If you go to the northwest, there's little. If you go to the southwest, there's little. In your area, there's probably more. But you know what? Our DNR has never mapped our groundwater, and we don't know whether what we take out in any project is sustainable. And that's one of the problems that we have. If we had that information, life would be easier for everybody. But we come in and start to work on a project and then go, oops, there isn't the water here. But the oops could be a second oops. If you don't do an EIS and you don't know that there's not enough water in this area, or that you go in and take all the water and all the folks around wells dry up, therein is a real problem. And if we had had a mapping of our groundwater in our state that was good, we would know the best places to site and the best places to avoid. But we don't have that at this point. I think we should go there. I think it would make a lot, make it a lot easier to do economic development if we knew where there was water and we knew there wasn't. We just only know generally. But in this case, I worry about the neighbors and their wells and their long-term groundwater. That would be a huge concern for me without looking at the water issue specifically. And there is no guarantee that an EIS would look at waters to the extent, not an EIS, an EAW, would look at water to the extent that it needs to be looked at. And this bill doesn't just happen in your area, where I suspect there is actually more water than in some of the other areas where I know there isn't. I mean, there are general maps that Natural Resources has for general areas of where they think there's very little water. But this is scary for me, for the residents around there and people who have wells without knowing what the aquifer looks like and who wins and who loses on the aquifer.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, I went on a tour of this plant. The new generation ethanol plant will be very similar to this one, and the environmental concerns are surely satisfied without an EIS. And they do go through a water permitting process, air quality, air emissions. None of that is negated. They still have to go through those. The aquifer is looked at, and just like it would be an appropriation water permit for irrigation, and it's estimated what the aquifer can take beforehand without an EIS. I was impressed with the sound policy they have in the environment and the overlook that they gave it. And so I found nothing to worry. I've been through these. We've got one going in June 6th, breaking ground, and one in my district that's similar to this. And I'm satisfied that they went through all the hoops and consulted with the DNR and the PCA, and they've got glowing reports, and it looks like all the permits are going to be issued and without an EIS. I think an EIS... we aren't shortcutting anything here. It's just taking away the mandatory overlook of the EIS that they would have to have otherwise.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative McGinnis, you bring up a very valid point. And most of the county I live in is over 100-mile underground lake called the Prairie du Chien Aquifer. And we have 48 lakes in the county that I live in, and this plant is right near a river called the Des Moines River. And we have not had a drought in my county in over 100 years. And we are definitely looked into, and part of the EAW process is to ensure that water will be there, and I share your concerns. If an EAW points out that there's going to be a water shortage, we are not like Marshall, Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now you scared me even more, Representative Gunther. If we're talking about going into the Prairie du Chien, which is a drinking water aquifer, to take out water that's used once and dumped, I don't think that's smart for us to do. We don't know whether it's sustainable. But if you were taking water out of the river, that would be one thing, and I think that would probably be acceptable. But you have two problems with the Prairie du Chien. That's drinking water quality, and we should save it for drinking water. And the second thing is, if you've got 48 lakes in the area, just a little lowering of the Prairie du Chien may mean that your lakes don't have what they need underneath them to be sustainable. That is the problem that we would see in the metro area, say up in Brooklyn Park, where they pump down too much water out of the aquifer. The wetlands dried up, and they'll never be replaced again. So there are major, major problems when you talk about using drinking water and having 48 lakes. I think they're big problems here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McGinnis, I did not say we're taking it out of the Prairie du Chien aquifer. I said it's there. Just like you said, the 48 lakes are there. And the DNR has a process in the EAW that they will ensure the water will be there or they won't approve an EAW. The permitting process is there for the water that is needed to operate this plant.
Representative Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of on the same vein as sustainability, I brought this up another day in committee, and a gentleman from the Met Council came up to me afterward and said, excellent point. We don't know if the water we use right now is sustainable, and the governor wants to begin to make inroads in that. I know someone who specializes in water in the state that's a constituent of mine. They did a very large report for Washington County. In the report, it states, we don't know if what we have is sustainable. The DNR is not able to do that kind of work. We're not allocating money for it. And I think it's just more of a long-term vision for us as a state. We need to know the cycles of drought and everything else and understand, you know, so that we can be responsive as our population grows and if we bring in another million people. And I think that's pretty much just the point, that we need to know what we have and what we need to do to make sure it's sustainable.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Wiginia.
Representative Gunther, would you be willing to limit your look to the river water for the water use?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wiginia, I don't know if that's feasible or not. I don't know the site. I haven't been there. I just know that the Des Moines River is within 5 miles of there. And I know that we have a lot of lakes, and we don't have the population that Representative Otto is talking about. Our population is shrinking, so we have more water than we did before for people.
Be recommended to pass as amended and placed on the general register. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The
thank you very much.
Bill is passed to the general register. Thank you, Representative Gunther. Representative Swenson. Representative Swenson moves House File 2478. Be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Is that correct, Representative Swenson?
I think so, yes.
Okay. Representative Swenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill I brought forward at the request of some gentlemen from rural Minnesota who felt that it was a need to address the issue. And I'll just say a few words, and then I have two gentlemen here with me that have had some experience with this issue and would like to testify. This bill, I think it's a short bill, and you've got a copy of it. You can read what it says. You know, sometimes out you have tile systems that are put into land that goes through more than one property owners. There may be an agreement among the property owners, but over time, some of these parcels could get sold to new property owners, and the issue we're talking here about is trees over drainage tile, which I would maybe you don't all know, but your tree roots can go down and plug up the tile and destroy them, and that's the issue here. That's brought this forward. With that, I would like to introduce Mr. Idy and Mr. Michalitz to give you some testimony of their reasons that they brought this issue to me. And Senator Dill has introduced it in the Senate also, and I would like to have you listen to them and the reasons that they brought the issue up.
Thank you. And if you'd identify yourself and who you represent for the record, and welcome to this committee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm Larry Idy from Lester Prairie in McLeod County. I have served on various different county and promotional boards. I am a lifelong resident of McLeod County. Why do we need this House File 2478? With more and more people moving into the countryside, our tile lines are ending up in the backyards next to their houses. We need those tile lines to work because they drain valuable cropland. If the tile lines are blocked off in any way or form, an example would be to plant trees on their property without checking where the tile lines are. They become useless because the tree roots block the tile lines that drain the valuable farmland used for crops. A person likes to be a very good neighbor, but it doesn't always work. We should not have to make laws. I believe we also should not have to make laws for everything in life. But it just doesn't work that way. Because when people move out from the towns and large cities, the new landowners do not understand how things work in the rural farmland. We'll take questions, but I would like to have Mr. Michalitz do his thing, and then we can take questions from everybody, okay? That be okay, Mr. Chairman?
That'd be fine. Thank you, Mr. Michalitz. If you'd state your name and who you represent, welcome to our committee.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, members of the committee. My name is Larry Michalitz, and I'm a lifelong resident of McLeod County, Lester Prairie, Minnesota, to be more specific. I am here representing myself as a landowner, also as an ag producer, and I have been on various boards in McLeod County and in the state, those on agriculture and non-agriculture, and I am presently on a local board of government. What I would like to entertain this morning with the members is mainly what is a tile line and how it was established. To give us a little background, tile lines are nothing new. They've been in the agricultural community for probably 60 to 70 years. These tile lines that we're talking about could be anywhere from maybe put in this last year, or could be up to 50 to 60 years old and still functioning. What has happened in the past is tile lines need to drain by gravity. And what has happened is sometimes these lines have got to go from one landowner to another. And the agreements made with our forefathers have been just verbally. And this has gone on very good. The maintenance agreements have worked between the two of them. Everything's been great. The situation we've seen coming up, as my fellow constituent mentioned, is this, that now those lands are being sold off to a second party where these tile lines go through. They no longer know about those lines. The real estate agent hasn't told them about them, so they don't know what exists. I guess our bill states that the tile lines over trees over tile lines, is an issue. Just a little bit more about tile lines. Tile lines are put in to drain off the surface water, so they're anywhere probably from 4 to 6 feet deep. And tree roots, trees especially, need moisture at certain times of the year. And as they get older, they take the roots down. certain tree species go into the tile lines and suck moisture. When they do that, they develop a growth, and in time, that will plug up the tile. I guess what we need to know is we need to have accessibility to those tile lines. And I guess, furthermore, we feel that the tile lines have been in there this long, and they need to function properly. And this is just one aspect that will really deter them from doing their job. So with that, I will end my discussion, and we will take questions from the committee.
Questions from committee members? Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does anybody keep track of where the tile lines are? Do the townships do that, or is this just pretty much a neighborly deal and you try to know what your neighbor's got going on?
Yes, this is pretty much over the years has just been a farmer-to-farmer thing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the older farmers now, in the case that I'm speaking of and have action with, is his dad is in the rest home, and his son has taken over the farm but has just simply rents it out to me. Now, there, where this tile line, certain tile line goes, is right through the property of across the road from another farmer selling off land to this city or town person. And that person, again, who sold the land, his dad, in turn, has been deceased. And I'm not sure, we've talked with him, that he even was knowledgeable that there was a tile line there. So we're running into a lot of these problems that way, that these tile lines have been in for a number of years, and they're coming up, and land is being sold, and nobody seems to know. In this case, I do know. So, yeah, we have a problem. I really like to work with people. But unfortunately, a lot of the town and city people that move out don't understand how the systems, the drainage water works. And it can be a problem. Sometimes the first person that owns those building sites are very reasonable. But it's maybe the second or third people that own those building sites as time goes along we have a problem with. So we as agricultural producers now with people moving out are finding we're having more problems with the people that are moving out, unfortunately.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cox, could I respond a little bit? The you asked, your question, I think, was, does anybody know where these are? Mm-hmm. I know from personal experience on our farm and over the past, generally when we have done tiling, the person that does the installation will leave us a map when he's finished, so that which shows the parcel land and where these lines are. But of course, over time, if they get new owners and so forth, it could be that there might be somebody that doesn't know. But I think if you look at this this bill, it says knowingly it's in there. So,
mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Guinness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Swenson, I think I understand your problem, but it sounds to me more like a legal issue rather than an environmental issue. And it sounds to me like we're creating easements here. And what I would suggest is that this bill go to civil law for folks to deal with this issue. I don't know that, in fact, I'm quite sure that it needs some oversight in that committee, because it does seem to be creating easements where there may not be any.
So, Swenson?
Well, I think this would be there probably was easements. There would have been, there wouldn't have been an agreement at the time these were installed, but of course it may not have been a written agreement, I think, like one of the gentlemen said, that, you know, there's tile lines out in the country that probably go through more than one property owners, but it's before they're installed, it's usually, there's usually an agreement among the owners. But I think the thing is here that I guess we all know that over time you have to change in ownership, and that's when you. But
any other questions?
I'd like to speak to that. The environmental part is because when you start putting building sites into a field, you change the environmental part of it. Okay. A lot of these tile lines were put in the lower parts of the field to drain out, not necessarily wetlands years ago, but just simply good cropland. And when you start putting trees next to houses, that in turn can change a lot of things, unfortunately. The tile lines would either have to be moved. If we would be next to a wetland, some tile lines drain into wetlands. We could have possibly a problem with the DNR changing that outlet. The trees on top of it, naturally we know trees make oxygen and everything. It can be a problem, and the drainage part of it too then, with the environmental part.
Yeah, Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if maybe Mr. Helen can help me understand what is current law. Mr. Helen, does the when you have drain tile that has been established across property lines, and now the second property downstream has on that drain tile changes hands, is there anything that prohibits that property owner from constructing buildings that obstruct those drain tiles, or actually busting the drain tiles up if they so chose, or what? Is there something in law that protects drain tiles on somebody else's property?
Mr. Helen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Osmond, I believe so. I can't tell you exactly what it does, but I think there are easements and drainage rights that are existing so that to prevent that from happening. But I can't cite you a statute where that is off the top of my head.
Representative Osmond?
And that's, I kind of thought that's what way it was, and I believe there's also probably statutes that already say you can't obstruct, knowingly obstruct, you know, those drain tiles. And I'm wondering why the redundancy of this as to what you think this is going to really accomplish, because I think what you're objecting to is already prohibited in statute. And the and by saying that they have to knowingly, they have to be aware that the drain tile's there, and most of the activities you've described is where they really don't know if the drain tiles are there. And so it may be a redundancy, but I don't know it's going to really help your problem.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I haven't discussed that with these gentlemen, and I could ask their response too, but my response to what you say would be that if you pass it out of here today, then probably with Mr. Helen there was somebody we could do some checking on that, and if we felt, you know, between maybe determine if it is necessary or if the protection is there already. And I don't know if you would care to respond to that.
Well, Representative Swenson, I think if it's okay with the committee members, we will pass your bill out of here and we'll place it on the general register, but I'll keep a close eye on this. I want you to find that information out for Representative Osmond and talk to me and him. And if this is already covered, we just won't bring it up on the general register. But we'll pass it out of here today. But we need to address these issues. And in the meantime, we'll talk to civil law.
I would appreciate that, you know, so we can just keep it.
We're running up against some deadlines.
I know that, too.
Is that okay with you, Representative Osmond?
Yes, Mr. Chair, because I believe they have a very legitimate concern. Yeah. I just don't know if this is really going to help compared to what's already in statute. So I think we need to continue to look at that.
All right. All right with you, folks?
Yeah.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, Representative Swenson renews his motion that House File 2478 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register, and we will check on those issues, right, Representative Swenson?
Yeah.
Very good. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. House File 2478 is placed on the general register. Okay, Representative Peterson. Committee, we're doing a good job. We've gotten through a number of bills today. That's right. We won't have to come in on Friday. I like it. Well, I will be here on Friday. I've got bills in two committees. While Representative Peterson's getting ready, I should say, too, like I said yesterday, we will have some committee time next week, 1 or 2 days. Everything on Thursday? Wrap up next Thursday. Nothing until Thursday for this committee. Oh, yeah, unless we get a bill referred to us or something, because we won't have any other room anywhere else. Yeah. Representative Peterson moves House File 2480. And Representative Peterson, where are we going to put that bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and committee members for your time and attention today. It's my desire to for you, Mr. Chairman, to consider moving this with recommendation to Environmental Finance.
All right.
And we'll get into the reasons why.
Okay, Representative Peterson moves House File 2480 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Environment Finance Committee. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring this up today, and I would like to draw your attention to the packet of photos that I sent out that are going around, and I'd like to bring your attention to, I think it's the second or third page, where you'll see the scale and the scope of the reason why I've decided to ask for and received a hearing on this bill, is that this is a area of the state where we have seen wetland loss over the generations and concentration of waterfowl, if you will, to the point where in this area farmers have taken to putting up fences in and around their fields so that there aren't more geese and ducks and similar going into the fields and eating too much corn. That's just one, or beans. That's just one thing to keep in mind as you hear other testimony today. With me, we are two representatives from the Lacaparra Yellow Bank Watershed District, Mr. Darrell Ellison and Mr. Willis Beecher, who have traveled at least 180 miles this morning to come and give their version of this this issue. Now, I'd like to also, because we're going to be hearing from DNR, I'd also like you to think back to, and some of these more senior members, to think back to as to what you've seen change or not change with management techniques. And the technique being employed by the DNR in this case on waterfowl and waterfowl management, if you will, is it's similar to thinking that I can recall from historical documents that I've read regarding in the 70s. Is that in the 70s it was said by hydrologists that it would be a good idea to get the trees out of the riparian area and get them out of the rivers and get them out of the area because that's going to reduce the flooding. That's a good idea, right? But in the 90s, we have decided that we're going to spend as much, and that's a good way to get into the riparian area to log big trees. That's what it was for. That's what the management was for. In the 90s, we reversed that, so we're spending all this money putting water, putting wood and things back into the floodplain, back into into the riparian areas and realizing that that was a mistake. Okay, this is a similar deal, but it's related to waterfowl and watershed management. Because we've lost some wetlands, and I think we can all admit to that, and there are less places for waterfowl to go to, the big areas of water that are available, and this is a relatively large area of water, and it's a unique place in Minnesota that is very Minnesotan to me, and it's always been in a certain place. It's a destination that has now been severely and significantly impacted, as you see the picture, the trench that has been driven right through this significant area of wetlands. Now, it's fine if you're going to have a management perspective that's going to change over the administrations and decades, but this is on private land with I'm not concerned about which account it did or did not come from and whose tax dollars or whose license fees and all those types of things did or did not pay for this. But it's significant money done on private land. And if a farmer tried to pull this off, they'd be strung up and run out of the state, and they would have so much coming down on them that it wouldn't even be able to be explained. Now, I think the goal is to drain this lake. There's a lake involved here, as you see those pictures. To drain this lake, to draw it down, to increase the aquatic vegetation that will come up naturally, and then have some freeboard space to play with as to ramping up or down the level of the lake, which will in turn increase in waterfowl management opinion the area of habitat for ducks and waterfowl, which is a laudable goal, but the way it was done is not, in my opinion, the appropriate way for our state agencies to manage our waters, public and or private. Because the cumulative effect is going to be that this has been drained, there are significant changes to the watershed attributes, the downstream flooding effects are significant, and they will attest to this in a minute or two. And, you know, the capacity on flood retention is tweaked, so watershed analysis and in-stream flows need to be amended and changed. So, you know, this is, if I could put it in a word, this is what you call a midnight excavating at its worst by a state agency that I've realized does not want to lose jurisdiction, doesn't want to lose domain or policy. That's understandable. But we've tried to work out over the last several months a memorandum of understanding between the Department of Natural Resources and the Watershed District that is here today, and it was promised, you know, in July, in a meeting, everybody was there, hands were shook, everybody was happy, everybody took off, we're going to have a memorandum coming to you pretty soon. Well, it came last night. And that's an indicator to me that the balking by the DNR is a little bit purposeful. And I would like for at least today, after we hear testimony from both sides of this issue, for it to be continued and moved into Representative Osmond's committee, because there are significant, if you will, analyses that need to take place as to whether or not, if this goes through, what it will cost the DNR to implement a permitting schedule for watershed district activities within the watershed district. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Daryl Elson and or Willis Beecher to explain to you the story behind what's known as the Twin Lakes Project.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm Willis Beecher, and I happen to be chairman of the Lacapal Yellowbank Watershed District. And this project is within our jurisdiction. I have worked with the watershed district since 1978, but I have been involved in soil and water conservation for 50 years. And we didn't know this project was taking place, and I guess that's what's bothering us. we didn't even know this project was taking place until it was already underway. And we're supposed to be the one that regulates waters and drainage in our watershed district. Now, when I first heard about it, I went out there, and by the way, this is located in a place where you can't see it. You can drive around the whole section and you can't see it because of the terrain. You can't see what's going on in this area. And we went out there and we seen that they were dredging an open ditch through this approximately 40 acres of pristine wetland in order to drain a 215-acre body of water. Now, when we first went out there, I couldn't believe my eyes. That's why we took pictures. Because it was the most devastating that I had ever seen in my 50 years of working with watersheds. I just could hardly believe it was happening. And so we had a couple including Aaron Peterson, a couple of legislators out there, and they felt the same way. They couldn't believe what was happening. We had one of our attorneys, who was Kurt Dieter, who was one of the foremost watershed attorneys in the state of Minnesota, out there to look at it. And when he got out of the pickup and looked, he said, "I can't believe this could happen." That's how bad it was. Now, we're concerned because this body of water gives us some flood control, which is very important in our area. As maybe some of you know, we just last year got a bonding issue through to build a Lazarus Creek Dam to control floodwaters that flood Dawson, Minnesota, Montevideo, and Granite Falls, and so forth. Well, this water goes into the same stream, the Lac La Parle River, as the Lazarus Creek water does. And so we're losing some flood control in this area, and that bothers us. Also, there's landowners below that were not consulted about this that are going to have flooding problems, including one guy that has a well that'll probably be flooded by the water that comes that should be in this lake, and it's now being drained. And this ditch, by the way, and I think there's some pictures that show you, was as much as 9.3 feet deep. So it isn't just a little ditch. It's really a gorge through there. And contrary to what I would have to do, I would, no private individual would be able to do this project. And the dirt was just thrown up on the side in the wetland through 6-foot cattails, which we just couldn't believe it happened. So that's really the reason for this bill, and it's very explicit here. All we're asking, and by the way, we're not down here asking for money. You'll be happy to hear that, I'm sure. And is that the DNR be required to come to the local authorities for a permit when they're going to affect drainage in that watershed district. Now, it's not a big deal. When we go to the DNR for a permit, we have to jump through 50 hoops to get a permit, and we maybe have to wait 3 or 4 months. Well, that's not the case with our watershed district. They come to us for a permit within 30 days. They'll know whether they have it or not, because we meet every 30 days, and we would immediately go out and survey it. And if the project was okay with the neighborhood, we would probably approve it. Now, this particular project, we didn't ask to be involved in this project to start with. We didn't even know it was happening until the town board in that area came to us and said, we want you to try to stop what's going on out there. And so we said, why? What's going on out there? And they told us. And so we said, well, call a meeting. And so they did. And people from the DNR office and Marshall and New Ulm were all at this meeting. There was about 40, 45 people there. I think five of them were agency people. And the rest of them were all interested parties, neighbors, town board, county commissioners, and et cetera, from Lincoln County. And of those people, there wasn't one that wanted to see this project go through. They were unanimous in saying, you've got to stop this project. And all we could say to them was, we'll do our best. We'll see what we can do. And so it turns out that we went to the court with it and to get a cease and desist order to stop them. And the judge ruled that the DNR did not have to come to us for a permit because they're a sovereign entity. And I think that's fine in a way, but shouldn't they be accountable for a project that's going to affect a local community this much?
Okay, Ms. Beecham, we've got to get going here, and we have to have somebody from the department come up also. We're going to be running out of time. Is that all right with you, Representative Peterson? We've got to wrap up here shortly.
Yeah, please. Okay. If Mr. Ellison could have sure. 1 or 2 minutes.
Sure. Well, very, very quickly.
Mr. Chairman and panel, I'm a coordinator for Lac Barrel Yellow Bank Watershed District, and I was out there with Willis Beecher the first day that we found out that they had actually went through it. We did have some notice that they were going to do something, but Mr. Beecher and David had stopped in the DNR office in Marshall and told them that we want to be notified before anything happened out there, and we never did get a notice on it. One thing that just to reinforce what Aaron said, back in July, Ron Harnick and a bunch of DNR people were at Lac Barrel County. We met in the commissioner room along with all the watershed board members, and they assured us that we were going to work on a MOU, and they said within a matter of a few days we'll get in touch with you. The day strung out to yesterday, and this was almost a year ago now. So we really don't have a lot of confidence in what they're doing so far. That's why we need a bill. That's why we need this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Hackbarth, and whoever you need next.
Okay. Any questions from the committee at this point? Okay, would the department like to come forward? Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Mark Holston, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Where to start? This is no small matter. This bill, as it's currently drafted, has dramatic implications, not only for the Department of Natural Resources, but for the state of Minnesota across the board. To the specific problem, and that's what we've got here, is we've got a conflict between the Department of Natural Resources and a specific watershed district. And start from the beginning. State law does not require the Department of Natural Resources from getting a permit from local watershed districts. We are exempt under the law from doing that. Now, does that mean we are exempt from a moral obligation of communicating with the watershed district or talking with them and working through them on specific projects? No, it does not. Will I say the department did its due diligence on this project up front? No, I can't say that we did. We have a problem that we are working to correct within the department to make sure that this relationship between all of our watershed districts is good and solid, and so that these conflicts don't arise as this one did. I will tell you that the watershed district was on three separate occasions notified the Department of Natural Resources applied for a permit into the waters division. Those permits were then sent to the watershed district for comment. Those were three separate incidences where they would have had an opportunity to know what was happening and comment on that permit. No comment was provided back to the department on that. Construction started, and in July I was notified that the project had begun. We'd gotten notice from that there was a problem with the watershed district and there was a discussion of a lawsuit. I immediately halted the project and started to analyze what was going on and told our people not to continue with construction and sit down and work out the problems with the watershed district. This continued, and yes, there was a meeting between the watershed district. I believe there was conference calls, a couple, I believe it was a public meeting and a couple other meetings that occurred. I was not involved in any of those. And where there was a discussion of a MOU or some type of agreement to be drafted up. We were then sued in September. And from that suit, we were found, so we did not continue with the MOU because the suit was filed. And we went to court. That court case resolved, and we continued on after the court case and continued with the project. Remember, this is a controlled project, controlled outlet structure. And so this is not going to be impacting downstream flooding. There are many of our projects, many of our retention areas, whether it's a retention pond or a lake, we have the ability to control and do control when the water is released. So in areas of concern or high water, we don't release. The release on these will be done strategically and timingly to prevent any impact to the downstream residents as much as you physically can make possible. But those are the considerations. This bill, unfortunately, has much broader implications than just the conflict that the department needs to work out and resolve with this particular watershed. This impacts anything we do. You want us, you direct the department to build a trail, trails will be impacted and permits will be required. You want us to do wetland restoration on any individual property owners, property owner comes to us to do wetland restoration, we'll be in dealing with permitting processes. Any type of trail from walking trails to ATV trails potentially will be impacted by these activities that you're asking us to do. Again, I can't apologize enough for our failure to communicate up front with this particular watershed, but I can tell you that we've tried to resolve those conflicts. We have not been able to resolve them. That's why the lawsuit was filed and went to district court. But I can tell you that we are working internally to correct these situations to prevent them from happening in the future.
Questions for the commissioner? Corny.
Just in layman's term, a short answer, what were the benefits of the project overall? I mean, what was it supposed to do? Glenn?
One of the techniques, Mr. Chair, one of the techniques that the department does on shallow lakes is try to mimic drought conditions. And it, what it does is it draws the lake down, could be for a variety of reasons. Water level's been too high. It's got invasive species, specifically carp, in the water. Carp and bullhead populations would stir the water up, preventing the appropriate type of plant life to grow that feeds waterfowl specifically and provide water, you know, the natural things that plants and water react. So the drawdown activity is to mimic a drought condition, draw those waters down to mimic a drought, which then release allows those, it kills off carp, kills off the bullheads, but also allows the natural plants to reseed or germinate that are there. And as we bring the water levels back up, those natural plants then come back and come back very strong, creating a very high productive waterfall habitat. And that's what the project for this one was designed for, was to create a large basin of high-quality waterfall habitat for the area to benefit from that.
Mr. President,
just a quick comment. The bill is so far-reaching and has such an impact on the stuff that we want to do for wildlife in the future and trails that I'm really worried about the bill, even though it looks like Commissioner Holston has admitted there were some errors and maybe possibly the way they were dealt with. It does look like a notification was made. I was under the impression that they heard from a year ago and nothing anything since, but it looks like they've been talking back and forth, but they just haven't been able to come to an agreement.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this is for either or both, but if this bill were to pass and this law were in place, what would be different?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, again, any activity that we would do that in and around water, we would be required to get a permit from the local watershed. That would be, as I said earlier, any project like this specific one, potentially any trail project, any water access project, to provide access to the lake, would be required to receive permit from the watershed district. They're numerous. I mean, it's what the department does.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, Deputy Commissioner Holston, there's one picture I'm looking at here, and the audience doesn't get to see it. It's got a picture of a track backhoe digging a trench across because it was dry last summer. It was dry in July. And is that a temporary drawdown of the upper lake? And just, was this a temporary ditch? Is that a temporary ditch they're digging with? It's going to be restored? I mean, is this part of the lake drawdown in that ditch? There's a number of disturbing pictures in there, but if they're a temporary lake drawdown and they're going to be restored back, my question is different. And if it's not the case, I think this is a pretty involved issue, Mr. Chair, and I'm just wondering with time, how are we going to be able to deal with this in an appropriate manner?
Commissioner.
Right. Okay, Mr. Chair, based on that photo, the head gate is, the gate or the control structure is off the left of that picture, and this area has been then restored and graded back out.
Representative McNamara.
Well, that answers my question. The picture really isn't a depiction of what really happened. It was a temporary, you answered my question there. But I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, is there a way we can lay this over or something? I just think there's some financial impacts here. It's going to finance.
There is some, Representative McNamara, there is some financial impacts here, and I think this needs a lot more work, and I think there's some other folks that want to testify, but we've got to get out of here. But if somebody else wants to come forward and speak for or against the bill, we're going to address that too. Get the testimony out of the way in this committee, move it to Representative Osmond's committee, to just so we're running out of time. And we'll move it to Representative Osmond's committee, and they can work on it in the meantime to straighten out some of these things. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ray Bowen. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts. I guess the concern about getting permits from watershed districts, I mean, an average citizen, if they come in and do anything with water, they have to get a permit. If it affects the hydrology of that watershed district, they have to get a permit. And I guess I don't understand why, if you do a project on this scale, why it would be so reprehensible to ask the DNR to have to do the same thing. But I do agree. This is a very broad issue. I guess what I would, I have been in contact and in discussions with the DNR over the past few days about it, about a memorandum of understanding, so we can get some understanding as to how watershed districts should be communicating with DNR and how DNR should be communicating with watershed districts. So I would hope that we would pass this bill on to Representative Osmond's committee so that we have an opportunity to keep those discussions going and perhaps come to some result. Thank you.
Mr. Bowen, do you know, without bringing the other folks up from the watershed district, was it communicated from the DNR to the watershed that this project was going to take place? I thought I heard testimony that that did take place. I want to know if it did or if it didn't.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't told that it didn't until after the project had been started.
Okay.
Yeah, Chairman Hackbarth, I mean, for some reason there was enough wrong with it to stop the project midstream, if you will, and touring it in this summer. You know, it just kind of, on numerous fronts, it's disturbing because, one, it's a little bit embarrassing that we have to go after certain bodies of water to improve waterfowl with land use management techniques over the last several decades that have we have to concentrate on what we have left. And sporting groups have been busy trying to invest in Canadian waterfowl activities, and maybe we should have been looking in Minnesota on the edge of the Prairie Pothole for years and years and years ago. So this hole was dug quite a while ago, and I appreciate your motion to keep this conversation going. I don't necessarily feel we needed to be here today if the memorandum would have been agreeable this summer and this past fall. So hopefully it can go to Mr. Osmond's committee with a recommendation.
So, McNamara, I think the commissioner would like to say a few more words. Representative McNamara.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that we move it to the Finance Committee without recommendation. I just don't feel comfortable at this point making a recommendation.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, sorry, I don't mean to take the committee's time, but again, this is an issue of you know, vital importance, I think. I don't want the committee to get an impression that the problem that we're having with this particular watershed is the problem we're having with all watersheds. Different geographical areas have different relationships. Our staff with the watershed districts, you know, it's a big state. We've got a lot of diverse individuals and personalities and a lot of different things come into play. I just didn't want the committee to get an impression that this was not an isolated incident. That is my understanding it is. To Representative Peterson's comment, the reason to stop it was I made that call when I found out that, you know, again, being in the department for the first time, and I mean, as deputy commissioner, wanting to work with communities, work with watershed districts, work with our partners out there to make projects work effectively. When I heard that there was a specific problem, one where communication tended to be was the problem, the issue, I halted the project in order that we could begin the communication process and try to resolve those conflicts. Unfortunately, when the district decided to sue, we halted that, and there was no reason for us to continue further until that lawsuit was over. So,
Commissioner, I agree with you. I know that the department does a good job in this area generally. This is an unusual situation. With that, Representative Peterson, are you okay with the motion that House File 2480 be re-referred to the Environment Finance Committee without recommendation?
Mr. Chairman and the committee, my original intent was to have it with recommendation, and Representative Seifert and I have been working on this. And with
Representative Peterson, you want the bill moved to Environment Finance?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Representative Peterson moves that House File 2480 be re-referred to the Environment Finance Committee without recommendation. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. Bill is moved.
Thank
Members,
you, sir.
Keep an eye on your email. If bills come to us, we might have to have a meeting on Tuesday or Wednesday, but at this time, only Thursday of next week is scheduled. So keep an eye on your email. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.